Snow Falling on Cedars, Disc 6.
Chapter 13. Hatsue Imada was standing in the foyer of the Amity Harbor Buddhist Chapel, buttoning her coat after services, when Georgia Yamashita's mother told the people gathered there the news about Pearl Harbor. "It's very bad," she said. "A bombing raid. The Japanese Air Force has bombed everything. It is bad for us, terribly bad. There is nothing else on the radio. Everything is Pearl Harbor." Hatsue pulled her lapels more closely around her throat and turned her eyes toward her parents. Her father, he'd been busy helping her mother into her coat, only stood there blinking at Mrs. Yamashita. "It can't be true," he said. "It's true," she said. "Find a radio. Just this morning they bombed Hawaii." They stood in the reception room kitchen with the Yamashitas, Ichiharas, Sasakis, and Hayashidas, and listened to the Bendicks sitting on the counter. Nobody spoke. They merely stood there. They listened for 10 minutes without moving, their heads down, their ears turned toward the radio. Finally, Hatsue's father began to pace and scratch his head, and then to rub his chin, long strokes. "We'd better get home," he said. They drove home and listened to the radio again, the 5 Imada girls and their parents. They kept the radio on all afternoon and late into the evening, too. Now and then the telephone would ring, and Hatsue's father, in Japanese, would discuss matters with Mr. Oshiro or Mr. Nishi. More than a half dozen times he made calls himself to discuss matters with other people. He would hang up, scratch his head, then return to his seat by the radio. Mr. Oshiro called again and told Hatsue's father that in Amity Harbor a fisherman named Otto Willits had put up a ladder in front of Shigeru Ichiyama's movie theater and unscrewed the light bulbs in the marquee. While he was busy at it, 2 other men had steadied the ladder for him and yelled curses at the Ichiyamas, who were not present. Otto Willits and his friends, on discovering this, had driven out to Lundgren Road and sat in front of the Ichiyamas in a pickup truck, where they pounded on the horn until Shig came out and stood on his porch to see what they wanted. Willits had called Shig a dirty Jap and told him he ought to have smashed every light in the marquee. Didn't he know there was a blackout? Shig said no, he hadn't known. He was glad to have been told. He was thankful to the men for unscrewing the marquee bulbs for him. He ignored Otto Willits's insults. At 10 o'clock, Mr. Oshiro called again. Armed men had posted themselves around Amity Harbor out of fear of a Japanese attack. There were men with shotguns behind logs along the beach just north and south of town. The defense of San Pedro was being organized. There were men meeting right now at the Mason's Lodge. The Otsubos had driven by at 8 o'clock and seen at least 40 cars and pickup trucks parked along the road near the Masons. Furthermore, 3 or 4 gillnetters, it was said, had left the harbor to patrol San Pedro's waters. Mr. Oshiro had seen one drifting on the tide, its engine cut, its running lights out, below the bluff near his home on Crescent Bay, a mere silhouette in the night. Hatsue's father, he spoke in Japanese, asked Mr. Oshiro if, in fact, there were submarines and if the rumors of an invasion of Oregon and California were factual. "Anything is possible," answered Mr. Oshiro. "You should be prepared for anything, Isao." Hatsue's father took his shotgun from the closet and set it in the corner of the living room, unloaded. He got out a box of squirrel loads, too, and slipped 3 shells into his shirt pocket. Then he turned off every light but one and hung sheets across all the windows. Every few minutes he would leave his place by the radio to pull back a corner of one of these sheets and peer out into the strawberry fields. Then he would go out onto the porch to listen and to search the sky for airplanes. There were none, but on the other hand, the sky was mostly overcast, and a plane would not easily be seen. They went to bed. Nobody slept. In the morning, on the school bus, Hatsue looked directly at Ishmael Chambers as she passed him on the way to her seat. Ishmael looked back and nodded at her once. The bus driver, Ron Lamberson, had an Anacortes newspaper tucked underneath his chair. At each stop he flung the door open with a flourish, then sat reading a section of the paper while the children boarded in silence. "Here's the deal," he called over his shoulder as the school bus wound down Mill Run Road. "The Japanese are attacking all over the place, not just Pearl Harbor. They're making raids all over the Pacific Ocean. Roosevelt is going to declare war today, but what are we going to do about these attacks? The whole fleet's been destroyed out there is the deal. And they're arresting Jap traders in Hawaii and other places. The FBI's in on it. They're getting them down in Seattle right now, in fact, arresting the spies and everything. The government's frozen Jap bank accounts, too. Main thing, there's a blackout ordered for tonight all up and down the coast. The Navy figures there's going to be an air raid. Don't want to scare you kids, but could be right here. The transmitter station at Agate Point. The Navy transmitter station. Your radio is going to be off the air from 7 tonight until tomorrow morning so the Japs don't pick up any signals. Everyone's supposed to put black cloth on their windows and stay inside. Stay calm. At school all day there was nothing but the radio. 2,000 men had been killed. The voices that spoke were cheerless and sober, and suggested a barely suppressed urgency. The young people sat with their books unopened and listened to a Navy man describe in detail how to extinguish incendiary bombs, and then to reports of further Japanese attacks, Roosevelt's speech before the Congress, an announcement by Attorney General Biddle that Japanese fifth columnists were being arrested in Washington, Oregon, and California. Mr. Sparling became restive and bitter, and began to talk in a desolate monotone about his 11 months in France during the Great War. He said that he hoped the boys in his class would take their duty to fight seriously, and that furthermore they should consider it an honor to meet the Japs head-on and do the job of paying them back. "War stinks," he added, "but they started it. They bombed Hawaii on a Sunday morning, on a Sunday morning of all things." He shook his head, turned up the radio, and leaned morosely against the blackboard with his arms seized against his narrow chest. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, Ishmael's father had printed and distributed the first war extra in the history of his island newspaper, a one-page edition with a banner headline, "Island Defense Set." Only a few hours after the outbreak of hostilities between Japan and the United States, San Pedro Island late last night was prepared, temporarily at least, for an air raid bombing or other serious emergency. A meeting of the Local Defense Commission was called promptly by Richard A. Blackington, Local Defense Commissioner, at the Mason's Lodge yesterday afternoon and attended by all Defense Commission lieutenants. An air raid blackout signal system, details of which can be found elsewhere in this edition, was established. It will rely on church bells, industrial plant whistles, and automobile horns. Defense leaders, taking the attitude that anything can happen, warned islanders to be on the alert to black out electric lights on extremely short notice. Island watchers for the interceptor command will be on duty on a 24-hour basis. Meanwhile, members of the island's Japanese community pledged their loyalty to the United States. Guards were trebled at the U.S. Navy's Agate Point radio transmitter station and at the Crow Marine Railway and Shipbuilding Company. The Pacific Telephone and Telegraph Company and the Puget Sound Power and Light Company indicated steps would be taken to guard their facilities here. Arrangements were being made to bring summer firefighting equipment, stored for the winter in Anacortes, back to the island today. Ensign R.B. Clausen, representing Commander L.N. Channing of the Agate Point radio transmitter station, addressed the Defense Commission meeting. "Military and naval intelligence units," he said, "have the situation well in hand and are taking proper local steps to guard against saboteurs and spies." The transmitter station went on prearranged war alert status immediately upon news of the Pearl Harbor attack, added Ensign Clausen. "Nevertheless, island civilians must do whatever they can, independent of naval and military aid, to safeguard their homes and businesses against sabotage or bombing." The following lieutenants of the Defense Commission were present at yesterday's meeting: Bill Ingram, Communications; Ernest Tingstad, Transportation; Mrs. Thomas McKibben, Medical Supplies; Mrs. Clarence Wuckstich, Supplies and Food; Jim Milleran, Auxiliary Police; Einar Peterson, Roads and Engineering; Larry Phillips, Auxiliary Fire Force; Arthur Chambers, publicity. Also present were Major O.W. Hotchkins, chairman of the separate local defense council, Bart Johansson, an assistant to Major Hotchkins, and S. Austin Coney, organizer of the island's Interceptor Command Force. At the bottom of the page, in bold 16-point type, was a message from the Island Defense Commission. At the sound of prolonged ringing of church bells, the prolonged sounding of automobile horns, and the prolonged blowing of whistles at the Crow Marine Railway and Shipbuilding Company, immediately turn off all electric lights. This includes the turning off of all permanent night lights, such as store display lights, which are under your control. Keep lights off until the all-clear signal, which will be a duplication of the air raid warning signal. There was also a statement issued by Richard Blackington that church bells and automobile horns should be used only in a manner consistent with the air raid warning system. Mrs. Thomas McKibben, in charge of medical supplies, requested that any islander with a station wagon available for use as an emergency ambulance should contact her at Amity Harbor 172R. She was also registering emergency nurses and those with emergency first aid training. Finally, the island sheriff, Gerald Lundquist, asked islanders to report suspicious activities or signs of sabotage to his office with all due speed. Arthur's War Extra included an article entitled "Japanese Leaders Here Pledge Loyalty to America," in which Masato Nagaishi, Masao Ueda, and Zenhichi Miyamoto, all strawberry men, made statements to the effect that they and all other island Japanese stood ready to protect the American flag. They spoke on behalf of the Japanese Chamber of Commerce, the Japanese American Citizens League, and the Japanese Community Center, and their pledges, said the review, were prompt and unequivocal, including Mr. Oyeda's promise that if there is any sign of sabotage or spies, we will be the first ones to report it to the authorities. Arthur also ran his editor's column under the usual heading of Plain Talk, which he'd composed wearily at 2 a.m. with a candle propped beside his typewriter. If ever there was a community which faced a local emergency growing out of something over which it had no control, it is San Pedro Island this Monday morning, December 8, 1941. This is indeed a time for plain talk about things that matter to all of us. There are on this island some 800 members of 150 families whose blood ties lie with a nation which yesterday committed an atrocity against all that is decent. That nation has committed itself to a war against us and has earned our swift and sure action. America will unite to respond courageously to the threat now facing us in the Pacific. And when the dust settles, America will have won. In the meantime, the task before us is grave and invites our strongest emotions. Yet these emotions, the review must stress, should not include a blind, hysterical hatred of all persons who trace their ancestry to Japan. That some of these persons happen to be American citizens, happen to be loyal to this country, or happen to have no longer a binding tie with the land of their birth, could all easily be swept aside by mob hysteria. In light of this, the review points out that those of Japanese descent on this island are not responsible for the tragedy at Pearl Harbor. Make no mistake about it. They have pledged their loyalty to the United States and have been fine citizens of San Pedro for decades now. These people are our neighbors. They have sent six of their sons into the United States Army. They, in short, are not the enemy any more than our fellow islanders of German or Italian descent. We should not allow ourselves to forget these things, and they should guide us in our behavior toward all our neighbors. So of all islanders, of all ancestries, the review would seek as calm an approach as possible in this emergency. Let us so live in this trying time that when it is all over, we islanders can look one another in the eye with the knowledge that we have behaved honorably and fairly. Let us remember what is so easy to forget in the mad intensity of wartime, that prejudice and hatred are never right and never to be accepted by a just society. Ishmael sat reading his father's words in the cedar tree. He was rereading them when Hatsue, in her coat and scarf, ducked in and sat down on the moss beside him. "My father was up all night," said Ishmael. "He put this paper out." "My father can't get our money from the bank," Hatsue replied to this. "We have a few dollars, and the rest we can't get. My parents aren't citizens." "What will you do?" "We don't know." "I have $20 from picking season," said Ishmael. "You can have all of it. You can just have it. I'll bring it to school in the morning." "No," said Hatsue, "don't bring it. My father will figure out something pretty soon. I could never accept your money." Ishmael turned onto his side, toward her, and propped himself on his elbow. "It's hard to believe," he said. "It's so unreal," answered Hatsue. "It just isn't fair. It's not fair. How could they do this, just like that? How did we get ourselves into this?" "We didn't get ourselves in it," said Ishmael. "The Japanese forced us into it. And on a Sunday morning, when no one was ready, it's cheap, if you ask me. They..." "Look at my face," interrupted Hatsue. "Look at my eyes, Ishmael. My face is the face of the people who did it. Don't you see what I mean? My face. It's how the Japanese look. My parents came to San Pedro from Japan. My mother and father, they hardly speak English. My family is in bad trouble now. Do you see what I mean? We're going to have trouble." "Wait a minute," said Ishmael. "You're not Japanese. You heard the news. They're arresting people. They're calling a lot of people spies. Last night, some men stopped at the Ichiyamas and called them names, Ishmael. They sat out front and honked their horn. How can this be happening?" she added. "How did things get like this?" "Who did that?" said Ishmael. "Who are you talking about?" "It was Mr. Willits, Otto Willits, Gina Willits's uncle and some other men. They were mad about the lights at the theater. The Ichiyamas left them on." "This is crazy," said Ishmael. "This whole thing is crazy." "They unscrewed his light bulbs and then drove out to his house. They called him a dirty Jap." Ishmael had no answer for this. He shook his head instead. "I went home after school," said Hatsue. "My father was talking on the telephone. Everyone is worried about the Navy transmitter, the one on Agate Point. They think it's going to be bombed tonight. There are men going out there with shotguns to defend it. They're going to sit in the woods along the beaches. The Shirasakis have a farm on Agate Point, and some soldiers from the transmitter station came there. They took their radio and their camera and their telephone. And they arrested Mr. Shirasaki. And the rest of the Shirasakis can't leave their house." "Mr. Timmins was going down there," Ishmael answered. "I saw him. He was getting into his car. He said he was going to the Masons first, where everything is being organized. They're telling people which beaches to watch, and my mother is painting these blackout screens. She's had the radio on all day." "Everyone's had their radios on. My mother can't move away from ours. She sits there and listens to everything and talks on the phone to people." Ishmael sighed. "A war," he said. "I can't believe this is happening." "We'd better go," replied Hatsue. "It's getting dark already." They crossed the small torrent of the creek below their tree and followed the path down the hillside. It was dusk and the sea wind blew in their faces. Standing in the path with their arms around each other, they kissed once and then again, the second time with greater force. "Don't let this hurt us," Ishmael said. "I don't care about what's happening in the world. We're not going to let this hurt us." "It won't," said Hatsue. "You'll see." Ishmael, on Tuesday, went to work for his father. He answered the telephone in the office on Andreasen Street and took notes on a yellow legal pad. His father told him to call certain people and made lists of questions to ask. Give me a hand, his father had asked. I can't keep up with it all. Ishmael made a call to the naval station. The pilot of a daily reconnaissance plane, said an ensign Clausen, had noticed something he'd never noticed before. The Japanese strawberry farms on San Pedro Island were planted in rows, pointing straight toward the radio transmitter at the end of Agate Point. The rows of berry plants could guide Jap Zeros straight to their target easily. But those fields have been there for 30 years, said Ishmael. Not all of them, replied Ensign Clausen. The county sheriff called in. Dozens of Japanese farmers, he speculated, had stores of dynamite in their sheds and barns which could be used for sabotage. Others, he'd heard, had shortwave radios. The sheriff asked that as an act of goodwill these farmers turn in such dangerous items to his office in Amity Harbor. He wanted, he said, a message in the review. He was thankful for Ishmael's help. Arthur printed the sheriff's message. He printed a notice from the Defense Authority telling Japanese nationals on San Pedro that as of December 14th they could no longer ride the ferries. 24 men, he wrote in a news article, had been named by Larry Phillips to the Civilian Defense Auxiliary Fire Force, including George Tachibana, Fred Yasui, and Edward Wakayama. Yes, I did. I singled those 3 out, he explained when Ishmael asked about it. Not every fact is just a fact, he added. It's all a kind of balancing act, a juggling of pins, all kinds of pins. That's what journalism is about. That isn't journalism, Ishmael answered. Journalism is just the facts. He had been learning about journalism at school from a textbook, and it seemed to him that his father had abridged some basic journalistic principle. But which facts, Arthur asked him, which facts do we print, Ishmael? In the next issue, Arthur reminded island businesses to extinguish display lights promptly at dusk. It was Christmas, and the temptation was to leave them on. He announced that on New Year's Eve a public dance would be held under the slogan, Remember Pearl Harbor, it could happen here. Men in uniform would be admitted at no charge. All islanders were encouraged to attend. Arthur informed his readers that a quota of $500 had been set by Mrs. Lars Heineman of the San Pedro Red Cross Relief Fund, and that the Japanese American Citizens League had immediately donated $55, the largest contribution to date. Another article reported that at the Japanese Community Center Hall in Amity Harbor, a reception had been held for Robert Sakamura, who'd been inducted into the Army. Speeches were made and food was served. A salute to the American flag and the loud singing of the Star-Spangled Banner rounded out the evening. The San Pedro Review printed a reminder to its readers that it was pledged to remain silent on military news that might comfort or aid the enemy. It furthermore counseled islanders not to talk carelessly of army or navy maneuvers which may be observed. The construction of the island's first fishing resort at Protection Point was delayed, Arthur wrote, because of the war. Nick Olofsson died while stacking wood. The George Bodines escaped death when their kitchen stove exploded, but Mrs. Bodine broke a leg and an arm. The PTA began a paper drive and took a special interest in Christmas wrappings. The island grange committed itself to the defense of San Pedro and promised in a letter to the Secretary of Agriculture to see to the production of such fruits and vegetables as can be grown on our island and as our fighting forces might need. The Army asked owners of mules and horses on San Pedro to register their animals with the county agent, describing the request in the pages of the review as a patriotic obligation. Islanders were also asked to check their automobile tires and to drive in a manner consistent with preserving them. Rubber was in short supply. The Navy warned islanders, in a message printed in the review, to kill a rumor by refusing to carry it further. Another benefit dance was held, and the enlisted men at the Agate Point station were invited as guests of honor. The Defense Fund Committee came to the school board with a request that the high school auditorium be made available for 2 future dances. The board, in return, asked for written assurance that there would be no smoking or drinking. A draft registration desk was set up at Fisk's Hardware Center. Meanwhile, a sudden warm spell turned San Pedro's roads to mud and sank automobiles up to their running boards. Eve Thurman, who was 86, stalled out on Pearsall Road in her 36 Buick, then showed up at Peterson's with mud caked on her knees. She'd walked 2 miles into town. Air raid rules, the review reminded readers, were now posted on many electrical poles. Keep calm and cool, stay home, put out lights, lie down, stay away from windows, don't telephone. Ray Ichikawa scored 15 points for the Amity Harbor High School basketball team in its victory over Anacortes. A half-dozen residents of West Port Jensen claimed to have seen a mysterious creature sunning itself in the shallows. It appeared to have a swan-like neck, the head of a polar bear, and a cavernous mouth from which emerged puffs of steam. When islanders rowed out to get a closer look, the creature disappeared beneath the waves. "This doesn't go in the paper, does it?" Ishmael asked his father. "A sea creature at West Port Jensen?" "Maybe you're right," answered Arthur. "But do you remember the bear stories I ran last year? The bear who was responsible for everything, suddenly, dead dogs, broken windows, missing chickens, scratched cars. A mysterious creature, that's news, Ishmael. The fact that people see it, that's news." In the following issue, Arthur printed a public service advertisement urging islanders to buy war bonds. He explained that the Civilian Defense Commission was registering boats that might be available in the event of an evacuation. William Blair, he told his readers, son of Zachary and Edith Blair of Amity Harbor, graduated in the U.S. Naval Academy's first emergency class and shipped out for the European theater. The island lost power for 4 hours one morning when a half-dozen of the Army's captive balloons broke away and dragged down power lines. The Defense Commissioner, Richard Blackington, appointed 9 district air raid wardens to be responsible for the effectiveness of an island blackout. He also attended, in Anacortes, a chemical warfare training class and afterward busied himself disseminating flyers about it. Meanwhile, the children of San Pedro Island had been numbered and registered in their school classrooms against the possibility of separation from their families. Arthur published a War Department chart showing wing and tail markings of airplanes. He also printed a photograph of Japanese Americans in Fresno, California, standing in line to get citizen registration cards. 4 more islanders of Japanese descent, this was a front-page article, enlisted in the United States Army. Richard Enslow, who taught woodshop at the high school, resigned his position and joined the Navy. Mrs. Ida Cross of South Beach knitted socks for sailors, sent them off, and received a thank-you note from an anti-aircraft gunner stationed near Baltimore. The Coast Guard banned fishing on the west side of the island and bore down on gillnetters in the middle of the night who had set nets near restricted areas. In late January, islanders experienced a temporary fuel shortage and were made to turn their oil heaters down by order of the Civilian Defense Commission. The commission asked farmers for 10,000 sandbag sacks, gunny, feed, or flour. 150 islanders attended first aid courses offered by the Red Cross Auxiliary. Peterson's store cut back on deliveries, citing fuel and labor shortages. "Seems like you're favoring the Japs, Art," an anonymous review reader wrote one day. "You're putting them on the front page every week and writing all about their patriotism and loyalty while saying nothing about their treachery. Well, maybe it's time you pulled your head from the sand and realized there's a war on. And who are you siding with, anyway?" In January, 15 islanders canceled their subscriptions, including the Walker Colemans of Skiff Point and the Herbert Langleys of Amity Harbor. "The Japs are the enemy," wrote Herbert Langley. "Your newspaper is an insult to all white Americans who have pledged themselves to purge this menace from our midst. Please cancel my subscription as of this date and send refund immediately." Arthur did so. He sent a full refund to each customer who canceled, and a personal note written in a cordial style. "One day they'll be back," he predicted. But then the Price Right store in Anacortes canceled its weekly quarter-page advertisement. Then Lottie Opsvig's apparel shop on Main Street, then Larson's Lumber Yard and the Anacortes Cafe. "We won't worry about this," Arthur told his son. "We can always put out 4 pages instead of 8, if that's what we have to do." He printed the letter from Walker Coleman, and another one like it from Ingmar Sigurdsson. Lillian Taylor, who taught English at the high school, wrote back in angry condemnation of the spirit of small-mindedness evident in the letters of Mr. Walker Coleman and Mr. Ingmar Sigurdsson, two well-known islanders who quite obviously have lost their grip on their senses while in the grip of war hysteria. Arthur printed that, too. Chapter 14. 2 weeks later, on February 4th, a black Ford threaded through the Imada's fields, making for the house of Cedar Slats. Hatsue was standing at the verge of the woodshed, filling her apron with cedar kindling from a pile underneath a sheet of waxed canvas, when she noticed, this was odd, that the Ford's headlights had been blackened. She heard the car before she saw it. It came to a halt just in front of her house. 2 men emerged in suits and ties. They shut their doors gently and looked at each other. One of them straightened his coat a little. He was bigger than the other, and his sleeves were not long enough to cover even half of his shirt cuffs. Hatsue stood silently with her apron full of kindling while the men mounted the porch and knocked on the door, holding their hats in their hands. Her father answered in his sweater and sandals, his newspaper dangling from his left hand neatly and his reading glasses perched on the bridge of his nose. Her mother stood just behind him.
"Allow me to introduce myself," said the smaller of the men, producing a badge from his coat pocket. "Federal Bureau of Investigation," he announced. "Are you Hiseo Imada?"
"Yes," said Hatsue's father. "Is something wrong?"
"Not wrong, exactly," said the FBI man. "It's just that we've been asked to search this place. You understand, we're going to search. Now, if you'll just step inside, please, we'll all sit down."
"Yes, come in," said Hatsue's father. Hatsue dropped her apron full of kindling back onto the pile of cedar sticks. The 2 men turned to look at her. The larger one came halfway down the porch steps. Hatsue walked out of the shadow of the woodshed and into the glow of the porch light.
"You come in, too," said the smaller man.
They crowded into the living room. While Hatsue and her sisters sat on the couch, Hisao brought chairs from the kitchen for the FBI men. The larger one followed him everywhere.
"Please, sit down," offered Hisao.
"You're real polite," replied the smaller man.
Then he took an envelope from his coat pocket. He handed it over to Hisao.
"It's a warrant from the U.S. District Attorney. We're going to search the premises. It's an order, see? An order?"
Hisao held the envelope between his fingers, but made no move to open it.
"We are loyal," he said. That was all.
I know, said the FBI man. "Still, we've got to look around."
While he spoke, the larger man stood and shot his cuffs, then calmly opened Fujiko's glass case and picked up the stack of shakuhachi sheet music she kept on the bottom shelf. He picked up Fujiko's bamboo flute, turned it over twice in his hands. Small hands for such a thick, cloddish man. Then set it on the dining room table. There was a magazine stand beside the wood stove, and he pawed through the magazines there. He picked up Hisao's newspaper.
"We've had some complaints from local citizens that certain enemy aliens on San Pedro Island have in their possession items declared illegal contraband," said the smaller man. "It's our job to search the premises for these. We ask for your cooperation."
"Yes, of course," said Hisao.
The larger man went into the kitchen. They could see him through the doorway, peering beneath the sink and opening the oven door.
"We're going to have to search through your private effects," the small FBI man explained.
He stood and took the envelope from Hisao. He put it back in his coat pocket.
"I hope you won't mind," he added.
He opened the tansu, a chest of drawers in one corner of the living room. He took out Fujiko's silk kimono with its gold brocaded sash.
"That's very nice," he said, holding it to the light. From the old country, it appears. High class.
The larger man came through the living room from the pantry with Hisao's shotgun seized in one hand and four boxes of shells against his chest.
"The guy's all armed," he said to his partner. "There's a big old sword back there, too."
"Put it all on the table," said the small man.
"And tag everything, Wilson. Did you bring the tags in?"
"They're in my pocket," Wilson answered.
The youngest of the Amada girls began to whimper, covering her face with her hands.
"Hey, little girl," said the FBI man. "I know this is kind of scary, but guess what? There's nothing to cry about, you hear me? We'll be done and out of your way soon."
The large man, Wilson, went back for his sow's sword. Then he turned his attention to the bedrooms.
"Tell you what," said the first man to his sow, "let's just sit tight until Wilson is finished. Then you and me will take a walk outside. We'll tag these things up and load them in the car. Then you can show me around your outbuildings. We have to check everything. That's the way it is."
"I understand," said Hisao.
He and Fujiko were holding hands now.
"Don't be nervous," said the FBI man. "We'll be out of your hair in a few minutes."
He stood at the table putting tags on things. For a while he waited in silence. He tapped his foot and put his mouth to the flute.
"Wilson," he said finally, "get your paws off the underwear."
Then he chuckled and picked up Hisao's shotgun.
"We gotta take this," he said apologetically. "All this stuff, you understand. They'll hold it for a while, who knows why, then they'll ship it all back to you. They'll ship it back when they're done with it. It's complicated, but that's the way it is. There's a war on, and that's the way it is."
"The flute is precious," said Hisao. "The kimono, the sheet music... You must take those things?"
"Anything like that, yeah," said the FBI man. "Any old country stuff we have to take."
Hisao was silent, his brow furrowed. Wilson came back from the bedrooms looking solemn. He carried Hatsue's scrapbook.
"Pervert," said his partner. "Come on."
"Crap," said Wilson. "I was going through the drawers. You do it next time if you don't like it."
"Hiseo and I are going out," the small man said firmly. "You can sit here with the ladies and finish up with these tags. And be polite," he added.
"I'm always polite," said Wilson.
Hisao and the small man went outside. Wilson worked on the tags. When he was done, he browsed through Hatsue's scrapbook, chewing on his bottom lip.
"Strawberry Princess," he said, looking up. "You must have been flattered by that."
Hatsue didn't answer.
"It's a good picture," added Wilson. "It looks like you. Looks just like you, in fact."
Hatsue said nothing. She wished Wilson would get his hands off her scrapbook. She was thinking of asking him, politely, to put it down, when Hisao and the other man came through the door, the FBI man carrying a crate.
"Dynamite," he said. "Look at this, Wilson."
He set the crate lightly on the table. The two men stood pawing through the dynamite, 24 sticks of it. Wilson chewed on his cheek and stared.
"You must believe me," insisted Hisao. "This is for tree stumps, for clearing land."
The smaller FBI man shook his head gravely.
"Maybe," he said, "but this is still bad. This stuff," he pointed a finger at the crate, "this is illegal contraband. You were supposed to have turned this stuff in."
They took the gun, the shells, the sword, and the dynamite, and put it all in the car trunk. Wilson came back with a duffel bag and stuffed in the scrapbook, the kimono, the sheet music, and, finally, the bamboo flute. When everything was loaded in the trunk of their car, the FBI man sat down again.
"Well," said the smaller one, "this is it. Guess what?" he said to Hisao.
Hisao didn't answer. He sat in his sandals and sweater, blinking, holding his glasses in his hand. He waited for the FBI man to speak.
"We gotta arrest you," said Wilson. "You're going on a trip to Seattle."
He unhooked a pair of handcuffs from his belt. They were clipped on next to his gun.
"You don't need those," urged the smaller man. "This guy here is a class act, a gentleman. There's no need for any handcuffs."
He turned his attention to Hisao.
They're just going to ask you some questions, okay? We go down to Seattle, a few questions, a few answers, the whole thing is over.
The two younger girls were both crying. The youngest buried her face in her hands, and Hatsue put an arm around her. She pulled her sister's head in close and stroked her hair gently. Isao rose from his chair.
"Please not take him," said Fujiko. "He has done no bad things. He..."
"Nobody knows about that," said Wilson. "There's nobody who can say."
"Probably in just a few days," said the other man. "These things take a little time, you see. We have to take him on down to Seattle. He's got to be scheduled in and all. Maybe a few days, maybe a week."
"A week?" said Fujiko. "But what we do, what do you..."
"Think of it as a war sacrifice," the FBI man interrupted. "Figure to yourself there's a war on, you see, and everybody's making some sacrifices. Maybe you could look at it that way."
Isao asked if he could change out of his sandals and get his coat from the pantry. He wanted to pack a small bag, he added, if that would be acceptable.
"Both," said Wilson. "Go ahead, we're perfectly willing to accommodate."
They allowed him to kiss his wife and daughters and to say goodbye to each. "Call Robert Nishi," Isao told them. "Tell him I am arrested." But when Fujiko called, it turned out that Robert Nishi had been arrested as well. Ranald Kobayashi, Richard Sumida, Saburo Oda, Taro Kato, Junko Kitano, Kenzi Yamamoto, John Masui, Robert Nishi, they were all in a Seattle jail now. They had all been arrested on the same night.
The arrested men rode on a train with boarded windows. Prisoners had been shot at from railroad sidings. From Seattle to a work camp in Montana.
Isao wrote a letter to his family each day. The food, he said, was not very good, but they were not really being mistreated. They were digging trenches for a water system that would double the size of the camp. Isao had gotten a job in the laundry, ironing and folding clothes. Robert Nishi worked in the camp kitchen. Hatsue's mother gathered her five daughters together, Isao's letters in her hand. She told her daughters, once again, the story of her odyssey from Japan on board the Korea Maru. She told them about the Seattle rooms she had cleaned, the sheets on which white men had vomited blood, the toilets full of their excrement, the stench of their alcohol and sweat. She told them about the waterfront cookhouse where she'd worked chopping onions and frying potatoes for Hakujin stevedores, who looked right through her as if she weren't even there. She knew already about hardship, she said. Her life had long been difficult. She knew what it was to be alive without being alive. She knew what it was to be invisible. She wanted her daughters to know how to face this in a manner that would allow them their dignity. Hatsue sat motionless while her mother spoke, trying to guess at her meaning. She was 18 now, and her mother's story held more weight than it had when she'd heard it earlier. She leaned forward and listened carefully. Her mother predicted that the war with Japan would force all her daughters to decide who they were and then to become more Japanese. Wasn't it true that the Hakujin didn't really want them in their country? There were rumors that all the Japanese on the coast were going to be forced to leave. There was no point in trying to conceal anything or in trying to pretend they were not Japanese. The Hakujin could see it in their faces. They were going to have to accept this. They were Japanese girls in America during a time when America was fighting a war with Japan. Did any of them want to deny it? The trick was to live here without hating yourself, because all around you was hatred. The trick was to refuse to allow your pain to prevent you from living honorably. In Japan, she said, a person learned not to complain or be distracted by suffering. To persevere was always a reflection of the state of one's inner life, one's philosophy, and one's perspective. It was best to accept old age, death, injustice, hardship. All of these were part of living. Only a foolish girl would deny this was so, thus revealing to the world her immaturity and the degree to which she lived in the world of the Hakujin instead of in the world of her own people. And her people, insisted Fujiko, were Japanese. The events of the past months had proved it so. Why else had their father been arrested? the events of the last 2 months should teach them something about the darkness in the hearts of the Hakujin and the more general darkness that was part of living. To deny that there was this dark side to life would be like pretending that the cold of winter was somehow only a temporary illusion, a way station on the way to the higher reality of long, warm, pleasant summers. But summer, it turned out, was no more real than the snow that melted in wintertime. "Well," said Fujiko, "now your father is gone, folding laundry in a camp in Montana, and we all must get by, endure. Do you understand?" she said in Japanese. "There is no choice in the matter. We will all have to endure." "They don't all hate us," Hatsue replied. "You're exaggerating, Mother. You know you are. They're not so different from us, you know. Some hate, others don't. It isn't all of them." "I know what you're saying," said Fujiko. "Not all of them hate. You're correct. But on this other matter," she still spoke in Japanese, "you don't think they are very much different? In some big way, Hatsue, different from us?"
"No," said Hatsue, "I don't."
"They are," said Fujiko, "and I can tell you how. The whites, you see, are tempted by their egos and have no means to resist. We Japanese, on the other hand, know our egos are nothing. We bend our egos all of the time, and that is where we differ. That is the fundamental difference, Hatsue. We bend our heads, we bow and are silent, because we understand that by ourselves alone we are nothing at all, dust in a strong wind. While the Hakujin believes his aloneness is everything, his separateness is the foundation of his existence. He seeks and grasps for his separateness, while we seek union with the greater life. You must see that these are distinct paths we are traveling, Hatsue, the Hakujin and we Japanese. These people seeking union with the greater life, argued Hatsue, are the ones who bombed Pearl Harbor. If they're so ready to bend and bow, then what are they doing attacking all over the world and taking over other countries? I don't feel I'm a part of them, said Hatsue. I'm a part of here, she added. I'm from this place.
Yes, you were born here, that's so, said Fujiko. But your blood, you are still Japanese.
I don't want to be, said Hatsue. I don't want anything to do with them. Do you hear me? I don't want to be Japanese.
Fujiko nodded at her eldest daughter. These are difficult times, she replied. Nobody knows who they are now. Everything is cloudy and unclear. Still, you should learn to say nothing that will cause you regret. You should not say what is not in your heart, or what is only in your heart for a moment. But you know this. Silence is better.
Hatsue knew immediately that her mother was right. Her mother, clearly, was serene and unruffled, and her voice carried the strength of truth. Hatsue felt silent, ashamed of herself. Who was she to say how she felt? What she felt remained a mystery. She felt 1,000 things at once. She could not unravel the thread of her feelings with enough certainty to speak with any accuracy. Her mother was right. Silence was better. It was something, one thing, she knew with clarity. "I could say," her mother went on, "that living among the Hakujin has tainted you, made your soul impure, Hatsue. This lack of purity envelops you. I see it every day. You carry it with you always. It is like a mist around your soul, and it haunts your face like a shadow at moments when you do not protect it well. I see it in your eagerness to leave here and walk in the woods in the afternoon.
I cannot translate all of this easily, except as the impurity that comes with living each day among the white people. I am not asking you to shun them entirely. This you should not do. You must live in this world. Of course you must. And this world is the world of the Hakujin. You must learn to live in it. You must go to school. But don't allow living among the Hakujin to become living intertwined with them. Your soul will decay. Something fundamental will rot and go sour. You are 18. You are grown now. I can't walk with you where you are going any more. You walk alone soon, Hatsue. I hope you will carry your purity with you, always, and remember the truth of who you are. Hatsue knew then that her pretense had failed her. For 4 years now she had taken her walks and come home offering fuki tendrils, watercress, crawfish, mushrooms, huckleberries, salmonberries, blackberries, even clusters of blue elderberries for making jam, anything to conceal her purpose. She had gone to dances with other girls and stood in a corner refusing requests, while Ishmael stood among his friends. Her girlfriends had sought to concoct dates for her. She was widely encouraged to make use of her beauty and to emerge from the shell of her apparent shyness. It had even been rumored for a while last spring that she had a secret boyfriend who was extraordinarily handsome, somebody she visited in Anacortes, but that rumor gradually evaporated. Through all of it, Hatsue had struggled with the temptation to reveal the truth to her sisters and school friends, because the truth was a burden to carry in silence, and she felt the need, like most young girls, to speak about love with other girls. But she never did. She persisted in the pretense that her shy demeanor in the presence of boys prevented her from dating them. Now her mother seemed to know the truth, or to have some inkling of it. Her mother's black hair was bound severely into a gleaming knot pinned to the back of her head. Her hands were folded majestically in her lap. She'd set her husband's letters on the coffee table, and she was perched with great dignity on the edge of her chair, blinking calmly at her daughter. "I know who I am," said Hatsue. "I know exactly who I am," she asserted again. But they were just more words to feel uncertain about. They were just more words to regret. Silence would have been better. "You're fortunate," said Fujiko evenly in Japanese. "You speak with great assurance, oldest daughter. The words fly from your mouth." Hatsue found herself walking in the woods later that afternoon. It was getting on toward the end of February, a time of only bleak light. In spring, great shafts of sun would split the canopy of trees, and the litter fall of the forest would come floating down, twigs, seeds, needles, dust bark, all suspended in the hazy air. But now, in February, the woods felt black, and the trees looked sodden and smelled pungently of rot. Hatsue went inland to where the cedars gave way to firs hung with lichen and moss. Everything was familiar and known to her here. The dead and dying cedars full of punky heartwood, the fallen, defeated trees as high as a house, the upturned root wads hung with vine maple, the toadstools, the ivy, the salal, the vanilla leaf, the low, wet places full of devil's club. These were the woods through which she had wandered on her way home from Mrs. Shigemura's lessons, the woods where she had cultivated the kind of tranquility Mrs. Shigemura had demanded. She'd sat among sword ferns 6 feet tall, or on a shelf above a veil of trilliums, and opened her eyes to the place. As far back as she could recall the content of her days, there had always been this silent forest which retained for her its mystery.
There were straight rows of trees, colonnades, growing out of the seedbed of trees that had fallen 200 years before and sunk and become the earth itself. The forest floor was a map of fallen trees that had lived 500,000 years before collapsing. A rise here, a dip there, a mound or mouldering hillock somewhere, the woods held the bones of trees so old no one living had ever seen them. Hatsue had counted the rings of fallen trees more than 600 years old. She had seen the deer mouse, the creeping vole, the green-hued antlers of the white-tailed deer decaying underneath a cedar. She knew where lady fern grew and phantom orchids and warted giant puffballs. Deep among the trees she lay on a fallen log and gazed far up branchless trunks. A late winter wind blew the tops around, inducing in her a momentary vertigo. She admired a Douglas fir's complicated bark, followed its grooves to the canopy of branches 200 feet above. The world was incomprehensibly intricate. And yet this forest made a simple sense in her heart that she felt nowhere else. She drew up for herself in the silence of her mind a list of the things now cluttering her heart. Her father was gone, arrested by the FBI for keeping dynamite in his shed. There was talk going around that before too long everyone with a Japanese face on San Pedro would be sent away until the war was done. She had a Hakujin boyfriend she could see only in secret, who in a few short months was sure to be drafted and sent to kill the people of her blood. And now, on top of these insoluble things, her mother had only hours before probed into the pit of her soul and discovered her deep uncertainty. Her mother seemed to know about the gulf that separated how she lived from what she was. And what was she anyway? She was of this place, and she was not of this place. And though she might desire to be an American, it was clear, as her mother said, that she had the face of America's enemy, and would always have such a face. She would never feel at home here among the Hakujin, and at the same time, she loved the woods and fields of home as dearly as anyone could. She had one foot in her parents' home, and from there it was not far at all to the Japan they had left behind years before. She could feel how this country, far across the ocean, pulled on her and lived inside her, despite her wishes to the contrary. It was something she could not deny. And at the same time, her feet were planted on San Pedro Island, and she wanted only her own strawberry farm, the fragrance of the fields and the cedar trees, and to live simply in this place forever. And then there was Ishmael. He was as much a part of her life as the trees. And he smelled of them, and of the clam beaches. And yet he left this hole inside of her. He was not Japanese. And they had met at such a young age. Their love had come out of thoughtlessness and impulse. She had fallen into loving him long before she knew herself, though it occurred to her now that she might never know herself. That perhaps no one ever does, that such a thing might not be possible. And she thought she understood what she had long sought to understand, that she concealed her love for Ishmael Chambers not because she was Japanese in her heart, but because she could not in truth profess to the world that what she felt for him was love at all. She felt a sickness overtake her. Her late afternoon walks had not concealed her meetings with a boy her mother had long had intuition of. Hatsue knew she had not fooled anybody. She had not fooled herself, as it turned out, either. She had never felt completely right. How could they say, she and Ishmael, that they truly loved each other? They had simply grown up together, been children together. And the proximity of it, the closeness of it, had produced in them love's illusion. And yet, on the other hand, what was love if it wasn't the instinct she felt to be on the moss inside the cedar tree with this boy she had always known. He was the boy of this place, of these woods, these beaches, the boy who smelled like this forest. If identity was geography instead of blood, if living in a place was what really mattered, then Ishmael was part of her, inside of her, as much as anything Japanese. It was, she knew, the simplest kind of love, the purest form, untainted by mind, which twisted everything, as Mrs. Shigemura, ironically, had preached. No, she told herself. She'd merely followed her instincts. And her instincts did not make the kinds of distinctions having Japanese blood demanded. She didn't know what else love could be. One hour later, inside the cedar tree, she brought this matter up with Ishmael. "We've known each other forever," she said. "I can hardly remember not knowing you. It's hard to remember the days before you. I don't even know if there were any." "My memory's like that, too," said Ishmael. "Do you remember that glass box I had? The one we took into the water?" "Of course," she said. "I remember it." "That must have been 10 years ago," said Ishmael. "Hanging on to that box, being out there in the ocean, that's what I remember." "That's what I want to talk about," said Hatsue. "A box in the ocean. What kind of a start is that? What really did we have in common? We didn't even know each other." "We knew each other. We've always known each other. We've never been strangers the way most people are when they meet and start going out." "That's another thing," said Hatsue. "We don't go out. That isn't the right word. We can't go out, Ishmael. We're trapped inside this tree." "We're going to graduate in 3 months," answered Ishmael. "I think we should move to Seattle after that. It'll be different in Seattle, you'll see. They're arresting people like me there, too, just like here, Ishmael. A white and a Japanese, I don't care if it's Seattle. We couldn't just go walking down the street together, not after Pearl Harbor. You know that. Besides, you're going to be drafted in June. That's the way it's going to be. You won't be moving to Seattle either. Let's be honest with ourselves." "Then what do we do? You tell me, what's the answer, Hatsue?" "There isn't one," she said. "I don't know, Ishmael. There isn't anything we can do." "We just have to be patient," Ishmael replied. "This war won't go on forever." They sat in silence inside their tree. Ishmael propped up against one elbow, Hatsue with her head perched against his ribs and her legs up against the glossy wood. "It's nice in here," said Hatsue. "It's always nice in this place." "I love you," answered Ishmael. "I'll always love you. I don't care what else happens, I'm always going to love you." "I know you do," said Hatsue. "But I'm trying to be realistic about this. It isn't that simple, is what I'm saying. There are all these other things." "They don't really matter," said Ishmael. "None of those other things make a difference. Love is the strongest thing in the world, you know. Nothing can touch it. Nothing comes close. If we love each other, we're safe from it all. Love is the biggest thing there is." He spoke with such confidence and drama about it that Hatsue allowed herself to be convinced by him that nothing was greater than love. She wanted to believe this, and so she indulged herself and tried to be swept up in it. They began to kiss against the moss inside the tree, but the touch of it felt to her false somehow. An attempt to obliterate the truth of the world and to deceive themselves with their lips.
"I'm sorry," she said, drawing away. "Everything is complicated. I can't forget about things."
He held her in his arms and stroked her hair. They didn't speak anymore. She felt safe there, as though she were hibernating at the heart of the forest, with time suspended and the world frozen, the temporary safety of a quiet way station one must leave in the morning. They fell asleep, with their heads against the moss, until the light in the tree went from green to gray, and then it was time to go home. "Everything is going to work out," said Ishmael. "You'll see. It'll work out."
"I don't see how," answered Hatsue.
The problem was resolved for them on March 21st, when the U.S. War Relocation Authority announced that islanders of Japanese descent had 8 days to prepare to leave. The Kobayashis, they'd planted $1,000 worth of rhubarb on 5 acres in Center Valley, negotiated an agreement with Torval Rasmussen to tend and harvest their crop. The Masuis weeded their strawberry fields and worked at staking peas in the moonlight. They wanted to leave things in good condition for Michael Burns and his ne'er-do-well brother Patrick, who would agree to take care of their farm. The Sumidas decided to sell at cut rate and close their nursery down. On Thursday and Friday, they held all-day sales and watched pruning tools, fertilizer, cedar chairs, bird baths, garden benches, paper lanterns, fountain cats, tree wrap, caddies, and bonsai trees go out the door with whoever was willing to take them. On Sunday, they put padlocks on the greenhouse doors and asked Piers Peterson to keep an eye on things. They gave Piers their flock of laying chickens as well as a pair of mallard ducks. Len Kato and Johnny Kobashigawa traveled island roads in a 3-ton haying truck, hauling loads of furniture, packing crates and appliances to the Japanese Community Center Hall. Filled to the rafters with beds, sofas, stoves, refrigerators, chests of drawers, desks, tables, and chairs, the hall was locked and boarded up at 6 p.m. on Sunday evening. 3 retired gillnetters, Gillen Crichton, Sam Goodall, and Eric Hoffman Sr., were sworn in as deputies by San Pedro's sheriff for the purpose of guarding its contents. The War Relocation Authority moved into musty offices at the old W.W. Beeson Cannery dock just outside Amity Harbor. The dock housed not only the Army Transport Command, but representatives of the Farm Security Administration and the Federal Employment Service. Caspers Hinkle, who coached the high school baseball team, stormed into the war relocation office on a late Thursday afternoon, everyone was just then preparing to leave, and slammed his roster on the secretary's desk. His starting catcher, second baseman, and 2 outfielders, he said, not to mention his 2 best pitchers, were going to miss the whole season. Couldn't this matter be thought through again? None of these kids were spies. On Saturday evening, March 28th, the Amity Harbor High School senior ball, its theme this year was Daffodil Days, went forward in the high school auditorium. An Anacortes swing band, Men About Town, played upbeat dance tunes exclusively. During an interlude, the captain of the baseball team stood in front of the microphone on the bandstand and cheerfully handed out honorary letters to the 7 team members departing Monday morning. "We don't have much chance without you," he said. "Right now we don't even have enough guys to field a team, but any wins we do get, they're for you guys who are leaving." Evelyn Nearing, the animal lover, she was a widow who lived without a flush toilet or electricity in a cedar cabin on Yearsley Point, took goats, pigs, dogs, and cats from a 6 Japanese families. The Odas leased their grocery to the Charles McPhersons and sold Charles their car and 2 pickup trucks. Arthur Chambers made arrangements with Nelson Obada to act as a special correspondent for his newspaper and to send reports to San Pedro. Arthur ran 4 articles on the imminent evacuation in his March 26th edition. Island Japanese accept Army mandate to move. Japanese ladies praised for last-minute PTA work. Evacuation order hits Prep Baseball 9. And a plain talk column called Not Enough Time, which roundly condemned the relocation authority for its pointless and merciless speed in exiling our island's Japanese Americans. The next morning at 7:30, Arthur fielded an anonymous phone call. "Jap lovers get their balls cut off," a shrill tenor voice had explained. "They get their balls stuffed down..." Arthur had hung up and gone on typing a story for the next edition of his newspaper, "Faithful to Praise Christ Easter Morn." On Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, Hatsue told her mother she was going for a walk. Her last walk before leaving, she pointed out. She wanted to sit in the forest, she said, and think about matters for a while. She left as if headed toward Protection Point, then circled through the woods to the South Beach Trail and followed the path to the cedar tree. Ishmael, she found, was waiting for her there with his head propped up on his jacket. "This is it," she said to him, kneeling for a moment in the entry. "Tomorrow morning we leave." "I've got something figured out," answered Ishmael. "When you get where you're going, you write to me. Then, when the school newspaper comes out, I'll send you a copy with a letter from me inside it and put journalism class for a return address. What do you think of that plan? You think that'll be safe?" "I wish we didn't even need a plan," said Hatsue. "Why do we have to do this?" "Write me at my house," said Ishmael. "But put Kenny Yamashita's name for the return address. My parents know I'm friendly with Kenny. You can write me at home with no problems." "But what if they want to see Kenny's letter? What if they ask how he's doing?" Ishmael thought about this for a moment. "What if they want to see Kenny's letter? What if you collect maybe half a dozen letters and stick them all in one envelope? One from Kenny, one from you, one from Helen, one from Tom Obata. Tell them it's a request from the school newspaper. I'll call Kenny tonight and tell him about it so it doesn't sound suspicious when you bring it up. Collect them all, stick yours in last. Send them all to me. I'll pull yours out and take the rest to school. That should work out perfectly." "You're like me," said Hatsue. "We've both gotten good at being devious." "I don't think it's devious," said Ishmael. "It's just what we have to do." Hatsue undid the belt on her coat, a herringbone wraparound from the pennies in Anacortes. Underneath, she wore an austere dress with a broad embroidered collar. On this day, she'd brushed her hair out long and tossed it to flow down the length of her back, unfettered by braids or ribbons. Ishmael pressed his nose against it. "It smells like cedar," he said. "So do you," said Hatsue. "It's your smell I'll miss as much as anything." They lay on the moss, not touching, in silence. Hatsue, with her hair coiled over one shoulder now, Ishmael with his hands in his lap. The March wind came up outside the tree, and they heard it tossing the ferns together, and the suspiration of the wind joined with the sliding of the water in the little creek just below. The tree muted and softened these sounds, and Hatsue felt herself at the heart of things. This place, this tree, was safe.
This ends Disc 6.